Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Vincent Warren of the Center for Constitutional Rights, who discusses the U.S. war on terrorism and the erosion of civil liberties in the United States 10 years after the September 11th terrorist attacks. Faz Shakir, Vice President of ThinkProgress.org, who summarizes the findings of his group's recently released investigative report titled Fear Incorporated, The Roots of the Islamophobia Network in America, and Anne McGrath Mulderry of the group September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows, whose son Stephen, killed on 9/11, explains how she transformed her grief into a prayer for peace and love. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In the decades since the 9/11 attacks, the FBI has unleashed thousands of paid informants to detect potential terrorist threats. At times, these informants have acted as agent provocateurs in crafting new terror plots. FBI informer Shadid Hussain posed as a recruiter for the Pakistani terror group Jaish-e-Mohammed in Newburgh, New York, a depressed Hudson River Valley town, and persuaded disgruntled Walmart worker Jamie Cromity to participate in a plot to bomb Bronx synagogues. The FBI has also conducted extensive data mining operations to pinpoint specific ethnic and Muslim communities for future undercover activities. According to Mother Jones magazine, the FBI is working with a strategy of preemption, prevention, and disruption of potential terrorists who might lead a lone wolf attack like the failed bombing of Times Square. Mother Jones and the University of California Berkeley Investigative Reporting Program reviewed 500 anti-terror cases over the last decade. They found half the cases involved paid informants, and nearly all of the high-profile terror cases were the result of FBI sting operations with informants involved in the plot. Documents discovered in the top offices of Libya's external security agency reveal a close working relationship on terrorism cases between Libyan intelligence, the CIA, and the British agency MI6. Intelligence cooperation dramatically increased after Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi dismantled his nuclear weapons program. From 2003 to 2007, Libya became a stop on the Bush administration's rendition program, where terrorism suspects were sent to third-party countries known for using torture. Libyans had a reputation for being particularly brutal to their political prisoners. In 1996, Libyan guards killed 1,200 Islamic inmates who waged a prison strike for better health care. Peter Bokert of Human Rights Watch told the New York Times the rendition program was about handing over these significant figures related to al-Qaeda so they could torture them and get the information they wanted. A document on the CIA found in the Libyan intelligence office referred to delivering suspect Sheikh Musa to custody in Libya and other top leaders of the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, who in the 1990s led an insurgency against Gaddafi. According to the Christian Science Monitor, the crackdown against Islamic insurgents extended to nearly all devout Muslims in Libya. A former political prisoner from that era reflected, "At the time, it was just enough to have a beard to end up in prison." When Steve Jobs stepped down as Apple's CEO for health reasons, he was lauded as a genius who revolutionized consumer technology with the iPod, the iPhone, and the iPad. But under Jobs' long tenure, the company also fueled the export of computer jobs to China and other low-wage countries. In 2010, Apple was linked to the tragedy of worker suicides at the Foxconn factory complex in China, which manufactures the iPhone and iPad. According to the news magazine In These Times, the dark underbelly of the tech industry has been largely forgotten due to Apple's soaring stock prices and Jobs' long record of creating the next must-have tech gadget. Since the 1970s, the U.S.-based computer industry has exploded to a $200 billion-a-year enterprise. But today, there are only 150,000 Americans working in the industry because production has moved to cheaper, low-wage labor markets. As Jobs unveiled a new version of the iPhone in 2010, the British newspaper The Daily Mail reported on the horrific working conditions at the huge Foxconn complex near Shenzhen, China. The plant's managers had just installed new security measures like wire mesh fencing to keep workers from jumping off tall buildings. Apple's own review of its suppliers showed extensive abuse of workers' rights. Over a third of its contract suppliers ignored Apple's rules and required employees to work over 60 hours a week. In addition, over 95 factories failed to conduct regular safety inspections, yet Apple only canceled two of its suppliers' contracts. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
September 11, 2011, marks the 10th anniversary of the terrorist attacks on the United States that dramatically changed the political and security landscape of the nation. Across the country this week, public observances, prayer services, and other events will commemorate the deaths of 2,977 victims that terrible day. Rather than treating the Al-Qaeda organized terrorist attacks as a heinous criminal act that could be pursued through the established national and international criminal justice system, President George W. Bush responded with a declaration of war. The desire of President Bush to retaliate against the attack with overwhelming force and his goal of overthrowing Saddam Hussein's regime led the U.S. into two wars, first in Afghanistan and then in Iraq, a nation with no proven connection to the 9/11 attacks. A decade later, the U.S. is still embroiled in conflicts in both countries. Putting the U.S. on a war footing also had important consequences for the civil liberties of foreign fighters held by the U.S. at Guantanamo Bay and other CIA-run secret prisons, as well as for American citizens. In defiance of the U.S. Constitution, the Bush administration engaged in the abuse and torture of detainees, warrantless surveillance of civilian communications, and subjected prisoners accused of terrorism to indefinite and preventive detention. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Vincent Warren, executive director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, which has been at the forefront of many of the lawsuits filed against the Bush and Obama administrations in an effort to protect civil liberties. Here he discusses some of the consequences of the war on terror 10 years later.
One thing that we can say very clearly is that when George Bush entered the first decade of the 21st century, he shredded the Constitution. Barack Obama is the president at the end of the decade, and what he is doing is refusing to put the Constitution back together again. What we saw under the George Bush administration was the advent of the war paradigm, which is treating things that historically and very successfully had been treated as criminal problems as a problem of war. So, for example, when you have terrorist activity and terrorist bombings and terrorist plots, that used to be considered criminal activity, and that it was a no-brainer 10 years ago that these cases would be investigated, that where there were allegations that could be made consistent with the law, they would be arrested and tried in federal courts. Now, 10 years later, primarily because of George Bush, the question of whether people will go to federal court or military courts or whether they'll even go to court at all for these types of activities is something that is not settled at all. And it seems to be at the whim of the political winds that are blowing rather than with respect to the rule of law. The presidential power grab that was started by the Bush administration and has been continued, frankly, with the Obama administration, I think really signals one of the most deeply troubling aspects of the fall, the potential fall of American democracy, the idea that there is literally no branch of government and there is no ability of the people to check the power of the president. It used to be that torture was anathema. Torture has now become a quote-unquote valid question to be discussed amongst academics, amongst the politicos, and amongst the general populace. Does it work? Is it legal? And things of that nature. What is true now was also true in 2001 before the World Trade Center fell down. Torture is a crime. There is no two ways about it. There is no justification for torture. And although President Obama has issued policy directives that torture should not happen, President Obama has not given up the authority to take any type of extra legal actions if he feels that the situation warrants. And so we don't have, allegedly, this CIA black sites where people were being tortured in secret, and we don't now see the same type of torture at Guantanamo that we saw before. But what we do see, like in a recent case when President Obama captured somebody that was involved in the Horn of Africa, rather than bringing that person immediately to federal court, what they did was they interrogated this person for months at a ship at sea, purportedly outside of the legal paradigm. This is a shift from what George Bush did in terms of tactic, but it's not a shift in terms of how this president sees his authority in a time of quote-unquote war.
Vince Warren, you know, that all makes sense in terms of what we've seen regarding the war on terror, but it seems so much at odds with how weak the president seems in confronting Congress on other issues. Is that just because maybe Congress and Obama agree on the need to continue the paradigm that George Bush started, or at least not to oppose it?
Well, I think we shouldn't confuse the power of the presidency with the potency of a particular president. And I think what is quite clear is that President Obama is making policy choices that many people in Congress, including and particularly the Republicans and the right wing, disagree with. And they're pushing back on him mostly for political reasons. So, for example, the president has moved to have some of the Guantanamo men tried in federal court, which is a very good thing. Congress pushed back on that, and the reason why they pushed back was not because they were so concerned about the rule of law, but because they were trying to make it difficult for him politically moving into the 2012 elections. Now, what President Obama didn't do is he didn't insist on the rule of law and insist that these people be tried in federal courts if there's a case against them, and he retreated. And so he's created a category of people in Guantanamo, which we estimate is about 40 people, that the president has no intention of trying whatsoever. So it's less a question of what the presidential power is and whether the president uses it for good and evil. The question really is, what type of potency does this president have to do the right thing, as opposed to getting pushback from Congress and then taking a compromise position that puts him squarely in George Bush land with respect to how he's feeling with the Guantanamo detainees. So what you have is a situation where Barack Obama, while it looks like it's difficult for him to move the men from Guantanamo into federal trials or to release them, and I think that's certainly true, he does explicitly retain the power to keep the men at Guantanamo if Congress doesn't let him move things forward. And that is no change from the George Bush position.
That was Vincent Warren, Executive Director of the Center for Constitutional Rights. To learn more about 9/11's impact on civil liberties, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Not long after the September 11th attacks on New York City, Washington, D.C., and the crash of a hijacked airliner in Pennsylvania, President Bush reminded the nation that the war against terrorism is not a war against Muslims, nor is it a war against Arabs. It's a war against evil people who conduct crimes against innocent people. In recent years, however, Bush's advocacy of tolerance and his message separating the violent acts of a few from the peaceful majority of the Islamic religion has seen substantial erosion. A new report finds that growing hatred toward Muslims in the U.S. is not spontaneous. Following a six-month-long investigation, the Center for American Progress recently released a report titled Fear Incorporated, The Roots of the Islamophobia Network in America, which traces $42 million in funding that has flowed from conservative foundations over the past 10 years to groups that have helped fan the flames of anti-Muslim hate in America. The report examines how funders, scholars, grassroots activists, media personalities, and political actors have effectively disseminated false narratives, including President Obama is a secret Muslim, that most mosques in America are incubators of radicalization, and that Muslims are attempting to covertly impose the Quran's Sharia law on the people of the United States. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Faz Shakir, vice president of ThinkProgress.org, a co-author of the Fair Incorporated report, who summarizes his investigation and the motivation and goals of those working to demonize Islam.
If you look at the Washington Post ABC News survey of American attitudes towards Muslims and Islam, it is actually far worse now than it was shortly after 9/11, that people view Muslims more negatively now than they have ever before. And I think that there's a reason for that. shortly after 9/11, President Bush, as a leader of the nation, but also his Republican Party, told his base that we aren't at war with Islam. And I think that was very helpful to tamping down his own kind of right flank that may have had an interest in trying to generate some kind of clash of civilizations theory. And for 8 years, I think he did a fine job of trying to hold that right flank down. And then, of course, once he left office, the Republican Party had a vacuum of leadership, and what you ended up seeing was a competition amongst right-wing fringe groups for attention. And one of those groups, as we document in our report, is the Islamophobia Network. It's really just a small group of individuals, five individuals who we list: David Yerushalmi, Robert Spencer, Frank Gaffney, Daniel Pipe, Stephen Emerson, who've been at this for a decade and have been producing reports suggesting that there's a, quote, creeping Sharia threat in America, that Muslims want to replace the U.S. Constitution with some Islamic law, that mosques are incubators for terrorism, that President Obama himself may be a secret Muslim. These are the kinds of theories that have been put out by a small number of people and have reached large audiences because there are a whole host of politicians and media players who are giving them a platform to spout their hate rhetoric. And what we try to do in this report is document who these small number of actors are and try to urge people to marginalize and distance themselves from this kind of hate rhetoric.
In your report, Fear Incorporated, you talk about the rise of hatred towards the Islamic religion in this country as not exactly being accidental. You document the enormous amounts of money that are being poured into the Islamophobia Network, as you call it.
Yeah, we document a little over $42 million over the past 10 years has gone to this small network of actors. It has come from largely seven conservative foundations. That money has helped seed a lot of these organizations that are devoted to producing anti-Muslim propaganda. For instance, Frank Gaffney's organization is called the Center for Security Policy, and what they have done with their money is produce reports claiming that Sharia is going to take over the United States of America. David Yerushalmi, one of Frank Gaffney's counsels, has authored legislation in various states to ban the use of Sharia by courts, and that kind of scaremongering, fear-mongering, when, you know, this is basically a baseless threat. There's no potential concern that Sharia is going to take over any judicial system in America, and yet there are people who are profiting off making that an argument. And to see their influence, quite frankly, is to watch how the Park 51 controversy blew up. You know, it originally started with Daisy Khan, who is one of the co-leaders of the project, going on Fox News with Laura Ingraham, and Laura Ingraham telling her that, you know what, I support your project. I appreciate what you're doing. You're trying to instill a moderate brand of Islam in America and trying to incorporate them into American civic life. It sounded like a good project, but within the next year and a half, you had Pamela Geller, Robert Spencer authoring blog posts and appearing on radio and attending rallies at New York City, calling this a victory mosque at ground zero. And it engendered a whole bunch of controversy. It came from just a small number of people, but ultimately ended up grabbing the whole nation's attention and even forced President Obama to weigh in.
Faiz, your report, Fear Incorporated, The Roots of the Islamophobia Network in America. What's been the response to the report so far, and what would you like ultimately to see be born out of the information that you investigated here?
Yeah, it's interesting what has happened since we released the report. The individuals that we cited, Robert Spencer, David Horowitz, Frank Gaffney, have all issued statements, and they have, in doing so, have revealed their true colors. So in almost every single one of those statements that they have issued in response to our report, none of them have challenged a fact about our report. The facts still stand as strong as the day we released them. But what they have done is suggest that we're, quote, part of the stealth jihadist campaign, that we are part of the Islamic insurgency or some kind of anti-Muslim innuendo has worked its way into those responses. And it just goes to show what they're all about. It's generally hate rhetoric, trying to smear you with some kind of tie to Muslim terrorism, and that's their modus operandi. What we're hoping to do is isolate them from everybody else, and hopefully have everybody else understand that these people are extremists.
That was Fawaz Shakir, vice president of ThinkProgress.org and co-author of the report, Fear Incorporated, The Roots of the Islamophobia Network in America. Find links to more information about the report and Islamophobia on our website at btlonline.org. In September 2001, Anne McGrath Muldery, mother of eight children and a retired educator and semi-retired writer, had been an active member of the national Catholic group Pax Christi, living in a small town south of Albany, New York. On 9/11, her son Stephen was killed where he worked in the South Tower of the World Trade Center. He died with his colleagues in a conference room on the 89th floor, where before the building collapsed, they shared a single cell phone to place calls and leave messages of love to those they knew they would be leaving behind. Shortly before President Bush launched his March 2003 invasion of Iraq, Muldery joined the group September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows, where she now serves on the organization's steering committee. Peaceful Tomorrows, founded by family members of those killed on September 11th, advocates for nonviolent options and actions in the pursuit of justice in an effort to break the cycles of violence engendered by war and terrorism. Among the group's goals are promotion of a U.S. foreign policy that places a priority on internationally recognized principles of human rights, democracy, and self-rule. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Anne Muldery, who reflects on the wars and violence that have followed the 9/11 attacks 10 years ago and explains how she transformed her grief into a prayer for peace and love.
Somebody said to me shortly after the terrible tragedy that they thought the people who had done this were certainly going to be in hell. Now, I was not made happy by that because I don't know hell. I don't know about hell. And I loved this person, though, who was talking to me. And that person cared so much about me that I said, you know, I don't know where they went, but they all went together. And the hijackers were as much my sons as Stephen. Their minds had been warped by leaders who told them that this was the right thing to do. And not only that, that God would be happy if they did it. Now, that's who I look to blame. Leaders who warp other people's minds and tell them to do something that is not good for the world.
And tell us why you joined with the group September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows, and what does the work that you do with that group mean to you?
Well, I'm 75 years old. I was 65 when Stephen died, and immediately after that terrible loss, that terrible shock in the family, my concerns were pretty much supporting one another to get through this. But I was not in favor of the bombing of Afghanistan. I never have favored bombing as a weapon of war. I feel, you know, that it cannot help but destroy innocent people. But I was alone in my thinking in many instances, and not looking for opportunities to proclaim my own beliefs. And then I came upon a news release that was sent by this group who I had never heard of, and it was September 11th, Families for Peaceful Tomorrows, and it was critical of the administration's preparations for the invasion of Iraq. And as I read that news release, I thought I could have written this news release. There isn't a word in it that I couldn't sign my name to. So I called these people up and reached them. They were a small group of maybe 40 people and growing. And I went down, and they were having a regular gathering, and I just joined them. And I thought, these people are worth leaving Kinderhook for, you know, to come and to do what I can do. And that's what I've done ever since. And what I do is, I speak around the country and even out of the country, and I write, and that's about what I do. I try to keep up with all of the issues that Peaceful Tomorrows as an organization is faced with. We are not foreign policy experts, of course. We're just human beings who were brought together because somebody we love died in the same terrible moment. But at the same time, we have come together to say that we want to be the voice of those family members who, like us, feel that retaliation, violence, is not going to do what people think it might. That's the tricky thing that you have to keep in mind. And one of the reasons I liked this group so much is that they chose for their name a quote of Martin Luther King Jr., which was that wars are poor chisels for carving out peaceful tomorrows. Reverend King was respecting the fact that some people believe that wars are the chisels to carve out peaceful tomorrows. Some people think it's the only chisel, and some people think it's the best chisel. Well, he reminds us they're very poor chisels, if that's your goal, a peaceful tomorrow, because violence begets violence, and I put it in my own mind that you're sowing dragon's teeth. They will come back to repay what you have done when you turn violent in your effort to rid what you perceive is evil from the world. That was what those hijackers were doing. They were using the deaths of innocent people to try and right what they perceived to be a wrong, and they perceived their victims to be their enemies. Well, that's history over and over and over and over again. There are plenty of instances in history where we can find examples that other means were reached toward the goal of justice and peace, if indeed that's truly what someone wants, and that when you do use violence, what you do is become the evil you're trying to destroy. At least that's my personal feeling about it, that if I use violence, I'm becoming what I'm trying to rid the world of.
That was Anne McGrath Mulderry, who serves on the steering committee of the group September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. Find out more about the group's projects by visiting our website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.